Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 9, delivered on February 11, 2010. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. That's the title of the chapter in the book, but as you well know, nothing is certain except for your death. So it is more appropriately risk and expected return. What you expect to get out of what you do. It may not happen, but you are not going to take the risk unless you expect something good to come out of it. So that does not mean always that we expect money to come out of a risky venture. It can be something other than money. It can be credibility with your friends. You might take some kind of a risk for the purpose of getting cred. You might take a risk for the purpose of getting sex. You might take a risk for the purpose of getting noticed just by the average person. Certainly, in some cases, we do not expect money as our return, but we can at least value it in terms of money. So in this class, we're talking about things that can be valued as your expected return. Now, here's what we're going to do. I've got a $10 bill right here in my hands. I got a $10 bill. Woman, I would like you to jump out that window. I was just checking. I know how to make those windows go up. I will give you $10 if you will just simply stand on the ledge and just jump off and land on the ground. There's snow on the ground. You'll bounce. And she is looking at me with this, can he please leave me alone? He's a pervert. I want him to go away. You're not going to do it, are you? No. Was. But you see, $10. $10. And I'm good for it. You see it right here. So there's a high probability that I will give it to you. But there is also a high probability that you will break your ass. And other parts south, down to your ankles. But you'll have $10. You ever seen the street outside of the university here right about at the time this class lets out, cars driving like blind trout trying to jockey themselves? If you would stand out there in that traffic, I'd give you this $10. Now, you have to crouch down real low so you look like a big lump of snow that the crazy people like to run over. But if you live through it, you get $10.
And you pay the medical bills?
No. I will provide a spatula. Now, obviously, he's not going to do it because there is a good chance that a big truck is going to drive by and the guy is going to be on meth or something trying to get a sixth load in for the day and he's going, man, man, ding, 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 ding. You're not going to do it, are you? No. See, the reward that he expects is not worth the risk that is going to be taken for it. Okay. It's just not worth the trouble. So when we talk about return, we really talk about expected return because there is nothing that is absolutely positively guaranteed in this life. And also, we have to talk about the two, your expected return in relationship to the risk. Now, have any of you ever seen any of the Jackass movies? You know, the... Or have you know about the Darwin Awards? the Darwin Awards. They are given to the people every year who have done humanity the greatest favor by removing themselves from the human genome, by getting themselves killed because of their stupidity. Now, are those people stupid that do this? Well, yes. But are they irrational? No, we're not going to say that. They just did not assess the risks properly. In the next lecture, I will break down the risks that face cash flow into several different types. But know this. The risks that we bear are not always rewarded. Only certain risk is even qualifies for an expected return. You are not rewarded for doing stupid, unless, of course, you're doing it for YouTube or something like that. You are rewarded only for risk that cannot be eliminated, that cannot be removed from a situation. Markets are extraordinarily objective, and they are cruel. You take on risk that the market does not deem is worthy of a reward, you run a very good chance of getting your ass kicked and making nothing. So I hear people say, well, I bought a stock and I made me a big amount of money on that stock. Just one investment? Well, I don't give a rat's ass. You were a stupid fool. You see, there is no reward for most of the risk that he took in gathering that stock. For every fool who brags about how he made a fortune, I'll show you 10,000 fools who never made a dime, but they're not going to brag about it because they know they were stupid. Look, oftentimes on these money shows, CNN and the CNN field, CNBC and all of those, they talk about the top performing money managers of the year. Well, this money market manager made a return of 28.6% for 2009. Isn't he incredible? Look at this fine, upstanding young Christian stud. I'm not impressed at all by that. Look. In order to make that kind of a return, he had to take extraordinary risk to do it. There are money managers out there who were pulling 7, 4, 9%. They're no less competent than the jackass who pulled the 28, 30% return. They just took a lower risk, probably because their investors didn't want high risk, high expected return. So there's nothing praiseworthy about some fool who gets a high return on his portfolio. He probably took a whole hell of a lot of risk to do it. So that's the start of this whole story. Let me go through. I'm going to show you. Risk does possibly reward you. And I want to qualify what I do here. Sometimes I'm going to say return instead of expected return. And I want to warn you, if I say that, do remember that it is expected return. We're talking about the future, where nothing is certain except for your death. Okay? And then it's all over anyway, so who the hell cares? But I'm going to start with showing you gains to leverage. Now, I think probably at least some of you have seen this before. I don't know. I honestly don't know. There have been semesters where people say, oh, yeah, I've seen this before. And then I've had semesters where, well, no, I've never actually seen this kind of a trick before. But let's talk about two people who are both going to buy houses. Okay? Now, you, sir, are going to buy this pretty little house where you are going to raise your pretty little family and all that great stuff. Okay? And you are one of those people, I do not want to take on debt. I just don't want to. It's not my thing. And there is a movement in this country, and I've met more than a few, interestingly, young people who say, I'm just not going to take on debt. Others say, oh, yeah, I'm going to take on debt. I'm going to owe the government for student loans for the rest of my miserable life and all that. It's a choice. But you are one of those people, I never take on debt. So we're going to have you buy a house at a price of $100,000. Now, the debt, you could get debt, and we'll just say at 10% to buy this house. But you say, no debt. So the interest you will pay in 1 year is zero. Now, the price when you buy the house was $100,000. And you anticipate that at the end of 1 year, you're going to flip this house when you divorce your wife, abandon the children, and run off with a videographer named Riley Hunter. You're going to be able to sell the house. Expected price at year one is going to be $110,000. Okay. Now, your gain will be, obviously, you are a mathematical colossus, $10,000. And your return, your expected return, will be, this time I've actually remembered to say expected, usually I forget, remember to put just put return, will be 10,000 divided by 100,000, and that'll be a return of 10%. You did good. Very good. Okay, now, we're going to do another person. You believe in debt. Charge it. On credit. Borrow. OPM. Do you know what OPM means?
Other people's money.
I love it. You do. OPM. Other people's money is so good compared to my own, because then when I lose it, all I say is, my bad. When I lose my own money, aw, shit! That's why I like to invite people to go to casinos with me. Dude, you got 20. So you too buy a house for $100,000. You borrow $90,000 on the house. So now, the interest at 1 year, and we're going to do 10%, is going to be what? $9,000. And the price, again, of that house is going to be $110,000 you're expecting it to be in 1 year. I'm leaving zeros off all the time. Okay, so now, let's talk about your personal gain. You sell the house for $110,000, right? You sell the house for $110,000, and then you have to pay off how much? $90,000, and you have to pay off how much in interest? $9,000. Whoa, I'm sorry. You sell the house, you have to pay off your principal, which was $90,000, and you have to pay off your interest, which was $9,000. Okay? So, 110, oh, help me out, for God's sake. 11,000. Okay, $11,000. But wait a minute. How much equity, how much money of your own did you put in? So your expected return is going to be $11,000 on an investment of yours of, what was your investment? $10,000. Whoa! Is that right? I hope I got the numbers right. Who has a higher expected return? Who? Talk? Oh, yeah. You, sorry, slob. I mean, 10% la-di-da. This guy pulled 110%. Suppose he had $100,000. He could do this 10 times over, and he'd have a huge pile of money. But on a return basis, he rules, not you, purely because he was willing to take on debt. But that means he was willing to take on risk. Because what happens if the house hadn't appreciated in value? What happens if the house had actually fallen in value, which it could have? All that house would have to have done to fall in value would have been, it would have had to fall only, actually, $11,000, any more than that, and you would have defaulted. The bank would have taken the house. You would have lost everything. In your case, the house could have fallen to zero. All you would have lost is your equity investment. You would have been creamed. You would have been wiped out if that house had fallen just a little bit in value, because the bank would have come in, seized it, your credit rating would have gone to zero, and then you would have had to borrow money from Cash Advance over on Main Street. And then you would have had, do you see the risk-return relationship? You're going to take on a higher risk, but you're also going to expect a higher return for it. That's gains to leverage. This, by the way, is the basis of, they were real popular one time. I see once in a while infomercials these days. Creative financing to make a fortune in real estate. This is the trick, trying to use leverage, debt, to up your gain. If you start with $100,000, you can either buy your house yourself, have no risk, have modest return. If you start with, and you borrow most of the money, and use only a little bit of yourself, you're bearing much greater risk, but you can actually make quite a bit of money doing this. And it's entirely a preference. Some people are highly risk averse. Some people are not that risk averse. And I bring this to you, thinking in your own mind, your risk aversion will be shaped by different factors. Your position in your life cycle, which, in other words, your age will be a factor. Also, your cultural upbringing will be a factor. There will be other factors. Most of you are actually fairly risk averse. You might imagine that you're wild and crazy. You're not. Have any of you ever met or been friends with someone who actually was just a batshit crazy mofo? Have you ever met those kinds of people? I ran with a crowd of those. They scare the hell out of me. I mean, 160 miles an hour, really? And you drive by a cop and outrun him on a highway outside of Miami? No, I don't like that. In the military, I met some people like that. No, this is a perfectly good airplane. I don't want to jump out of it. The props are still spinning. Oh, you're going to kick my ass out. There were people who actually ran out. Wee-haw, you idiot. See, different people have different risk aversions. Also, different companies have different risk aversions. Did you see Amazon.com? Remember Amazon.com, those financials? What would you say? Is that a highly risk-averse company as far as debt goes, or a considerably less risk-averse company as far as debt goes? What would you estimate there for Amazon.com? Go ahead, talk. Yeah, it is actually a fairly risk-averse company. It was avoiding lots of debt in its capital structure. It prefers not to leverage. It gives up the gains to leverage, but at the same time, the owners of the company can sleep a little better at night. Do you notice how the company's aversion of risk resulted in a lowering of the return on equity? Well, okay, fine. The company's owners might like a higher return on equity. They'll get out of the company. But then another clientele that likes companies that aren't risky will come in. So in different areas, so you'll see different companies have different risk aversion structures, and that results in different shareholder compositions. So, and you also see this in portfolio management too. Some people will embrace risk And I know I've met some people, they just say, volatility is everything. The more volatility, the better. In other words, they're saying, I want risk because that's how I make the big bucks. And then there are other people who are scared to death of risk. They don't want risk. So they would probably invest in things like bonds. Why are bonds less risky than stock? Do you know, I'm kind of interested if you know why bonds are less risky, all other things being equal, than stock. What's the reason? Do you know? Just got an idea? Go ahead. Oh, no, they're not backed by the government. Well, anymore, for God's sake, with the way we're bailing out companies, yeah. But, no, in general, they're not backed by the government. Go ahead. You got to say it. Kind of somewhere in the same right universe. Here it is. The shareholders have the residual claim to the cash flow. Residual. That means that you have to pay the debt holders their money before you can pay one dime to a shareholder in dividends. If you don't give money to the shareholders, if you don't have any money to plow back into the company, to build the company, nothing's going to happen to you except for a bunch of bitchy shareholders at the next shareholders meeting. If you don't pay your interest on your bond, if you don't pay the face value when the bond retires, you will be taken to a court, and the court has the power to simply destroy, kill, end your corporation. That's it. So if you don't pay the bonds, that's the end of your corporation. You don't pay the interest, you don't pay the principal either. You're done. That's the end. The corporation dies. The shareholders have nothing like that. No claim except for whatever is left in scraps after the debts have been paid in a timely manner. That's why shares, stock, is riskier than debt. And, well, surprise, surprise, that's why the expected return on stock would in general be higher than the expected return on a bond. A bond will be safer than stock, all other things being equal, and therefore it will have a lower expected return. So that means that right now, madam, if you suffer a very serious injury, you're young, you will heal. Well, mostly, with proper plastic surgery, you will heal. But you see, when you are, and there will be doctors who are, well, we've got to make this woman beautiful again and all that kind of stuff. But when you're 80 years old, who cares? You get mangled in an accident. You grow to look, you say, nah, not that much worse than what I was before. I do that now. You know, when I was 20, damn, I got to fix that zit. Now, if I get a zit, I say, yeah. And the same thing goes for your finances, too. If you take a bad hit now, you've got a lot of time and a lot of resources to recover. But if you took a hit when you're 70 years old to your financial situation, a major hit, God, that's pretty much it. You might as well pull the tube that's stuck into your kidney. I mean, it's over for you. You see, that's why you would see people at your age more likely to invest in portfolios of stocks. But when you get into the 50s, 40, even in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, people would be more likely to start tilting their portfolio toward bonds, towards safety, toward more certainty of the income flow. Even though it would be lower, it would be less likely that you would get a major hit that would harm your financial status into your golden years. Okay, so that's the idea that I'm trying to get to here. Just setting up the background, which is important as we go through this course, is that the risk that we take is shaped by our preferences, by our age, by a lot of factors. But there is one thing that is for certain. The greater the return you expect, the greater the risk you must bear. But again, not all risk is rewarded. And I do this next part. Now, there's some math in this lecture. And you saw a little math there. It's kind of dumb math. I'm not even sure I did that calculation right, but I've got the point across anyway. But look, this next thing I could do mathematically with some equations and formulas and all that. But I found that I don't really need to do this next piece with math, but I do invoke a mathematical concept called the correlation coefficient. The correlation coefficient is a measure of the volatility of two things relative to each other. The correlation coefficient. So, and it goes between negative 1 and 1. So if a correlation coefficient, and I believe the book uses the Pearson correlation coefficient. There are several, I think. There's a Stearman, is it called? But anyway, look, if two things have a correlation, if two cash flows, let's say, had a correlation coefficient of 1.0, the highest it could be, that would mean that the cash flows are actually moving perfectly together through time. Their volatilities are identical. Okay, that would be a 1. Now, a negative 1 would mean that they're perfect mirror images of each other through time. This correlation coefficient idea is quite useful, and we measure a lot of things. We use this correlation coefficient all the time. It's a simple tool, and it's actually an effective tool. Now, a correlation coefficient of 0 would mean that we can't find any relationship between the two things. They both have volatility, but there isn't any match between them, either positive or negative. Now, here's the thing. If I buy a stock, it's going to have a lot of volatility, most likely. From day to day, it's going to pop up and down, and up and down, and up and down. We hope that it will go generally upward through time. So if I were to measure time against price, I would see some kind of a pattern like that. Now, that is volatility, which is a representation of risk of this company's stock. Now, a lot of that volatility, you'd say, well, I'm going to expect a return for that volatility. But the market's going to say no. Because you see, I can get another stock. Now, stocks tend to have positive correlation coefficients. Not 1, but something above 0. So I buy a second stock, and its correlation coefficient is not exactly the same. It goes up sort of like the pattern looks somewhat similar, but it's not as strong. Okay? Now, clearly, there is a positiveness. You can visually see positive. That's one of the nice things about the Pearson, is you can look at the visual and you can say, yeah, I see. There is a bit of relationship. But you see, if I own these two stocks together, they're going to help cancel out a little bit of each other's volatility. They really will. Now, a couple of points, they'll probably kind of magnify each other. But there are going to be many places where they will actually smooth each other out. See this place here where there was this major down drop? A significant down drop happened on the other stock, but not at the same time. So that this spike, if I own both these spikes, the blue, the second stock's upstroke, is going to help mitigate the black downstroke. And then as the black is upstroking again, the blue will tend to mitigate it somewhat. So if I held both of these stocks together, the volatility of the portfolio would not be as large as the volatility of either individual stock, because the individual stocks are not perfectly correlated. They can still be positively correlated, but because they're not perfectly correlated, in other words, the correlation coefficient isn't one, the ultimate portfolio will probably have considerably less volatility than either of the two stocks did individually. This is the beginning of what we call portfolio diversification. As you put more stocks into a portfolio, because their correlation coefficients wouldn't be one, I don't think I've ever seen two stocks that have a correlation coefficient of one, they will cancel each other's volatilities out a little bit. And as you add more, you will get more of this effect. It will get less and less as your portfolio expands. But once you get to about, let's say, 30 stocks, there's not a lot more that can be gained by putting more into your portfolio as far as risk mitigation goes. Here's the deal, though. Because you can do this, because you can remove much of the volatility from any individual stock, no market is going to reward you for that part of the volatility that you bear because you didn't do that. In other words, the only part of volatility, the only part of risk that you are rewarded for, that you should expect a reward for, is the risk that cannot be diversified away. Because if you can diversify away a risk, no one's going to reward you for it, especially an objective behemoth like a stock market. So here's the thing. There are two points of risk to consider. There is diversifiable risk, and then there is non-diversifiable risk. The only reward for which you should expect, the only risk for which you should expect a reward is the non-diversifiable component. The risk that stays there like a hum once all of everything has been taken out. Where does that risk come from? Look. Diversifiable risk comes from all kinds of places. A company stock goes up and down because of all kinds of things. Minor incidents in the company, major incidents in the company. The CEO died. Well, that's going to cause the stock price to hop around. Well, this company had a great sales year because they came out with a new toy. Well, that's going to make the stock price pop around. Those are peculiar to that company. Well, this industry has been hit by competition from overseas. That's diversifiable because there are other industries that didn't get hit by that competition from overseas. All kinds of sources of volatility affect a company, affect an industry. But they don't affect every company and every industry. So that means if you bought stock of companies in other industries, you wouldn't have that volatility. So, there are these things that happen at the peculiar level. Those, you're not going to get rewarded for the volatility that is created by those. But there are things that happen to all companies. The hum of non-diversifiable volatility. Macroeconomic events that hit every company. Those are a source of non-diversifiable risk. That's the kind of risk that you do get rewarded for bearing, or you should expect to get rewarded for bearing. Macroeconomic factors are global factors. Those are the sources. You can diversify all you want, and no matter where you go, no matter what stock you buy, that risk will be there. That's the kind of risk for which you should expect to get rewarded. So as you diversify away, from one stock to two stocks to five to 10 to 20 to 30, what's happening is that you are smoothing out the peculiar risks of companies and of industries. But what you cannot smooth out is those factors that affect all companies and all industries alike. That's where you get your expectation of reward. And again, so when you say, I bought a stock and I made a lot of money on it, I don't care. I'm not impressed. You're a dumbass. You buy a diversified portfolio. Don't do side bets, for God's sake. You're a stupid fool because you're taking risk that you don't have to take. Buy a diversified portfolio. Make the portfolio risky. Buy risky stocks. Put them in there. Borrow money to buy more. That's fine. Great. Then you're diversifying away the risk that you don't have to bear that the market's not going to reward you for anyway. For every person who makes a fortune, and I'll repeat this, for every person who makes a fortune buying one stock or two stocks, there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of people who get their asses kicked doing that. And they are the ones you will never hear from because they're not going to get up on TV, "Ha, I got my ass kicked buying stocks, so I'm going to sell you my secret." And there's the other part of it too. If anyone ever tells you to pay him or her money so he can tell or she can tell you the secrets of making a fortune in the stock market, you know what? If he's really making a fortune in the stock market, he ain't going to tell you. The way he's making his money is off suckers like you who think he is. Okay? That's the reality of it. Now, what does that mean for you? Should you go out there and buy a stock here, buy a stock there? The bad part about that is transactions cost. The transactions cost will kick your ass. I don't care if you've got one of those discount brokers. 7 cents a trade. Don't do it. There's an easier way to diversify. Does anyone know what it is? Anyone know? Yeah. Mutual fund. It's a mutual fund. A mutual fund buys a portfolio of stocks, and then you buy a share of the mutual fund, and therefore you are participating in the smoothing of the volatility that the market fund manager, the mutual fund manager, is doing. And if you're good at it, if you're smart, you probably buy several mutual funds just to do super diversification. And you choose mutual funds that target your risk preference. If you're the kind of person who's risk averse, you look like a very risk averse person. Indeed, a conservative. You probably sit at home every night reading your Bible, closing your windows, avoiding the world because it's dangerous out there. So you would probably buy a mutual fund of very safe old companies with cash cow products, have some bonds in the portfolio, something very safe like that. You, on the other hand, you look crazy. Those eyes, God. No, noob, I'm serious. Those eyes. God, you're crazy. Don't enlist. You're the guy we had to shoot, okay? Yeah, I'm going out there. No, no, no. You see, you're going to go with a mutual fund that invests in young, upstart companies, possibly even NASDAQ, that kind of stuff. And so you would be able to, there's a clientele effect. You would move towards mutual funds that have higher risk portfolios of stocks, young companies, risky companies. You'd avoid those. You'd go with those very conservative companies, old, staid companies that don't move around too much. Okay? Now, I know that's not investment advice because I know you're actually a very, very conservative person. You're actually the wild mofo. But now I go on about this because one of the funniest things that is, for some of you anyway, this will be your only finance course you ever take at the college level. And technically, this is what I teach in an investments course, in the stock courses and all that kind of stuff. And I just harp and rage almost the same lecture. real early on. But with you guys, if I don't tell you this, a lot of you would never hear why diversification of portfolio is so important. What's the logic behind why we talk about portfolio diversification? And also this thing you often hear, should you move your stocks around? You read the paper, oh God, I'm going to buy this because I just read the paper and there's something hot happening with this company. Here's some advice for you. Don't do it. Don't be stupid. Buy, hold, buy, hold. You know why it's stupid for you to jump on every hot tip you read in the stock market papers every day? You know why that's stupid? Because I can promise you, I have been to New York. I've been in the rooms where there are computers so fast, they acquire information so rapidly and execute on that information that they actually are reaching a couple of microseconds into the future now. At Goldman Sachs, they can beat you to the market because you can't see the future. Even if you call your broker E.F. Mutton 2 seconds after you read something, Goldman Sachs has already executed the trades on it, puts the price up, so you get screwed. You can't win that game. Don't try. Seriously, noob, don't do it. Lay off. Okay? And you think I'm joking? It's high-volume trading, HVT, high-volume trading. Goldman Sachs has a patent on a computer program. They have servers that are so fast, they can see people like you moving towards the buys, and they do what's called the consensus of the herd analysis. They look at what the herd is forming to do, and they execute it before the herd actually knows that it's made a decision. They're so fast that they can get it before the herd starts to act, even before the other fast brokers. Their servers are so fast. They literally are looking at what is going to happen. Are they perfect at it? No. It's about 70% time the consensus of the herd is right, the way they're doing it. 70% of the time is more than enough to beat your ass, and you'll lose. Don't try to play that fast trade, shift here and there game. You aren't going to win. Buy and hold, and just hang on. Move your portfolio as you see your own needs changing. And as you see that the information is changing that you have about not just yourself, but about the market conditions, then make your trades, shift, rebalance your portfolio. But trying to beat the market, don't do it. You won't win. How serious is Goldman Sachs at what it's doing? The program that they're using to get consensus of the herd and attack and hit, predict the future was stolen by one of their employees or a consultant. He got to Germany with it. Goldman Sachs had enough power that they got our own FBI to go over there and get him and arrest him and bring him back and save the program from being shared. That's how serious they are. They can get our government to do their bidding on this. You think this sounds like conspiracy theory? It's not. This is just what happens. This is how it's working now. Well, and you will recall, by the way, that as I said, the best way to predict the future, create it. Welcome to the 21st century. Now, here's what we do from here. I have to show you scenario analysis. This is, in a sense, like that, what if? And there might have been other courses you've taken where they said, ask yourself the question, what if? Why not? How much? Who farted? The important questions. Well, here we reach out to the future ourselves. Now, we do not have crystal balls. Unfortunately, we're not as good as Goldman Sachs. We're not as good as the prognosticators of Wall Street and all those kinds of people and the religious leaders. We don't see the future perfectly. But that doesn't mean we can't take a good stab at what happens. So in business, we would be fools not to consider what the future might look like. But we're not going to say, this is going to be the future. The better way to do it is to say, let's lay out some probabilities of different futures and what they would mean to our cash flow. So what I'm going to do here is I am going to say, we'll just use revenue sales for next year, for, let's say, for this year, 2010, at the end of the year. Let's lay out. And we'll see, we'll say condition of economy. And I'm going to lay out five scenarios. Okay? Now, in the first scenario, five scenarios, and then I'm going to assign a probability for each scenario. So the probability, scenario on the first row, probability on the next row. So let's say that it's possible that the economy for 2010 is going to suck. I mean suck. It sucks, S-U-X. There's a probability of 10%, 0.10, that could happen. Then we'll say, well, there's also a probability that it's not good. It doesn't suck, but it's not good. And let's say that that probability is 0.20. Now, we can go on to the other side, and we can say, wow. Yes, World of Warcraft. Wow. That's a 10% scenario that it's going to be a banner year. Let the good times roll. Break out the pancakes, Ma. We're eating tonight. I don't know what the hell that meant. Okay. And then there's a scenario where it's pretty good. And we'll say that there's a 20% chance, 0.20, of that. And then, of course, there's the middle ground. Meh. Thirty percent chance of that, 0.30. Now, the scenarios have to add up to a probability of 1. You probably remember that from somewhere. We have to exhaust the possibilities. Well, okay, so we've got sucks, not good, meh, pretty good, wow. And this is actually doing five scenarios. I saw there was this cat. He was an actuarial jockey, and he was doing one of these. He had it laid out, what was it, like 11 scenarios? You know, dude, don't do that. Then I realized he had a really great computer, and so, of course, he could do it. He could just lay in the numbers and crank them out. This, by the way, what I'm going to do here, if you're any good at all at Excel, this is Excel turf, because otherwise you're cranking numbers way too much. I mean, it gets to be really old, real fast doing these calculations. That's why, of course, I'm going to have you doing it on the exam. Okay, so let's talk about the middle scenario would be that our sales would be 50 million. And I'm going to write 50 here. If as long as you do this, drop the same number of zeros everywhere, it won't hurt this. Just make sure you drop the same number of zeros everywhere. Okay, and then in the not good scenario, 40 million. In the sucks scenario, 30 million. Now in the pretty good, we'll go up to 60 million. And then we'll, in the wow scenario, 70 million. Now if you've got your calculators, for God's sake, bring them out. And I want you to do this with me. No, this isn't for your benefit. It's to make sure that I don't make a mistake. Okay. Yes, it is. What did I do? Oh, that's supposed to be a 40 right there. I'm sorry. Change that to a 40. You're right. There's a 40% chance of meh. I actually was thinking it's got to be a 40 because I'll have 30 on either side. Now, notice something here. This guy is a symmetric distribution. This guy's a symmetric distribution. Now, the first thing that we do is we get the expected value of this of your sales. Now, it probably won't shock you when we do expected value. And this is a formula. I'm going to write the formula. The formula is just something that you can show to other people so that they can be extraordinarily impressed. The expected value of the sales revenue is going to be the sum from I equals 1 to N of the sales sub I. Okay, awesome formula, times the probability of that scenario. Okay, so what does that mean? Really, the expected value is going to be 0.1 times 30, 0.10 times 30,000, plus 0.20 times 40,000, plus 0.40 times, 50,000, plus 0.20 times 60,000, plus 0.10 times 70,000. Okay? And what do you get when you do that? What? Unless you got a really cool cell. Well, who was it? I saw it. It's been a couple of months ago. Someone had a cell phone that had like this awesome scientific calculator inside. That was sweet. But anyway, what do you get? What do you suppose you're going to get? Oh, excuse me for having a fat ass. I'll get out of the way. What do you get? Oh, spank me, Jesus, yes. Don't always think it's going to work out that way, but our... So our expected value will center on the middle of this distribution. Now, I made this one essentially like a chunky bell curve, a chunky normal. Chunky because it's not smooth, it's lumpy. But usually I'll do these with these smooth symmetric functions like this. Otherwise, things get really weird sometimes. That tells us where we expect to land. Okay, now I'm going to tell you about that. It is very likely that you two will someday be in a plane crash. Horrible. You won't make it to LA, which was where you were trying to get. But I can promise you one thing. You will make it to the crash site. Bank on that. Now, it's possible that you could hit in front of LA. You could actually bounce and go to the other side and go into the ocean and get eaten by sharks. It's possible that you could land down in Cabo San Lucas or land up in San Francisco. But you see, we expect you to land here at the center of the distribution. And as long as it's symmetric, the expected value will be on the center. But you see, that doesn't tell us what we really, really would like to know in a class, in a lecture on risk. What we really want to know is what the spread is. We need a standard measure on the spread of this distribution, which takes us to the next part, which is where we will get a variance, which would be the sum, Well, it's going to be the square root of this mess. I equals 1 to n of each sales value minus the expected sale quantity squared, times the probability of each incident. That's volatility. That's a measure of the spread. It's called, that's V. I want that to be standard deviation. Standard deviation. Square root of it's the standard deviation. Here's the idea. You see, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take each scenario's possibility minus what I expect. Now, that will give me an idea of the spread between any a scenario and what I expect. But I have to square it simply because if I don't, the negative hits will cancel out the positive hits. So I square it, then multiply by the probability, and then I've got to have a huge-ass number. Then I take the square root of it to get it back down into normal territory. Here's the payoff. Once I get this number from this complicated formula here, I can tell something very useful about the future. I can begin to have a sense of how likely the future, different futures are. So in this case, probably if you're doing this by hand, really, you take each one, 30,000 in this case, minus the expected value, and I get, in this case, negative 20,000, and then I square it, and then that would give me some big-ass number, 1, 2, 3, 4. So that'd be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And for God's sake, someone do this. And then I times it by the probability of that scenario. And I just crank them down the line for every one of them. For the next 140,000 less 50,000. See how squaring takes out? Now, I think I've got the right number of zeros there. If I don't, say something. And then I take this one, which is trivial. I'm going to write it, but that one will be a zero, so the center expected value isn't going to do anything for us. Oops, 0.40. And then you'll find that the ones on top, you'll save yourself some time if you notice that there's a pattern that's going to repeat. Do you see the pattern that'll happen on the upstroke? Watch. 60,000 minus 60,000. Then I square that, and then I get 60,000. Do you see how it's going to repeat on the other, on the top stroke, what happened on the bottom stroke by the squaring process? And then am I writing the right number of zeros here as I go along? Okay. And I'm being real sloppy with how I'm doing my representations of squares and equals and all of that. I do recognize that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Then you do all those calculations. Once you've done those calculations, you take the square root of the result. Notice that if you make a little mistake, it causes pain. Anywhere along the line, watch your ass. Now, as I said, you have a problem like this on your first exam. And it goes beyond this even. It goes into a great deal of depth with what we use this for after we get this. Now, am I a total jerk? No, I don't want you slashing my car tires. In fact, the weekend before, the 2 days before the exam, I tell you the scenario on my website. Here are the numbers. And then that gives you a chance to get it and work it out before the exam, if you decide, if you choose to. So you have the opportunity, because otherwise, if I just gave you the problem straight up, that'd be an exam right there. You wouldn't have time to do anything else except to go out to my car and smash the windows or something. So I do give you plenty of warning on what to do on a problem like this. Not what to do, I'm sorry. The numbers that would be that you will be using. And then when you get the exam, there's the problem. And so then you should be able to say, oh, well, I already worked this out. Now, did anyone actually get the damn answer here? I'm going to have to crank this because I got to get this number, and I can't find the sheet. I had the sheet with the answer on it, and I can't find it in my notes right now. So if I do this on, I would get, what is it, 20,000 squared times 0.1 plus 10,000. Oops, squared times 0.2 equals, and then if I times that by 2, I would repeat the other side, and then I take the square root, and I'm not making any promises whatsoever on this, but it looks like it comes out to be $10,954.45. So, $10,000. If I do all this and then take the square root, I get my standard deviation, which I write as a sigma, SD of S. We write it as a sigma. I've taken, added up all those, taken the square root, and I get $10,954.45. And I'm making no guarantees whatsoever that I got the number actually calculated right on the fly like that, but it looks like that's it. Now, what does that number mean? It actually means this. As long as you've got a symmetric distribution, I know, let me do this. That between $39,045.55 and $60,954.45. There's a 67% chance that my actual cash flow for my actual revenues for 2010 will be in that range right there. Now, how did I do that? Expected value minus sigma up to the expected value plus sigma. There's a 67% chance that I'll be in that band right there, based upon my scenarios. I also know this. I also know this. If I want more certainty, a higher probability, I can tell you this right now. 50,000 minus 2 times that between 28,091.10 and $71,908.90, I have a 95% chance. There's a 95% chance that I'll be somewhere in that range of sales for the year. How did I do that? I took the expected value minus twice sigma up to the expected value plus twice sigma. It's just probability stuff. I can even go up to a higher probability. I think it's like 99%. Three standard deviations, yeah. See, but of course, to get more certainty, I'm going to have a wider band. In the realistically, most, the several times I've seen these scenarios done in backroom projections, they're mostly interested in the 95%. That seems to be what the big one is the two standard deviations on either side. So, although they do ask about the 67% and the 99%. But that's the band right there. And that's what you're doing. That's the useful part of what I've done here, is that it gives us, it doesn't tell us the future, but it gives us some sense of where we probably would land based upon how probably we want to talk. There's one more little formula that I want to bring up here. One more. It's the one so that we can compare different companies, different scenarios for different years, different companies, whatever, or different parts of a financial statement specifically. It's called the coefficient of variation, CV. And all it does is just take sigma and divide it by the expected value. It's a way to standardize the volatility measure, sigma. Sigma measures volatility, but sigma carries the information of the numbers from what we were doing. If you use a CV, that takes away the peculiarity of the numbers that were on the line here, 30,000, 40, 50, 60, 70. That way, with the CV, we could look at the sales line CV, we can look at the gross profit line CV, the operating profit line CV, the net margin CV, and we could look and compare the volatilities. And they would be meaningful relative to each other, the number. That's why the CV is useful to us, because it divides out the effect of how big the expected value was. So as the net margin is smaller than the sales, sigma would change, but CV would take out the effect of the fact that sales are bigger than net income. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.